Good evening, everybody. You know, midot are very hard to change. Character traits. And everybody's born with a set. Some are good, some are not so good. And life is a training process to fine-tune what we were given initially and make it work towards self-perfection. Now, there's a big conflict when you put to mind that in raising children, we have to give them self-confidence. It's a very big issue not to deride a child, not to give them a low opinion of himself. And so self-esteem is crucial to the success of an adult. By the same token, we're taught that gaava, conceit, is abominable in the eyes of Hashem. I like that's one of my favorite words. Abomination. I thought it was like next door to the delicatessen is an abomination. But it puts us in a hole as to what should we do with our children? Are we creating a baal gaava, someone who's so conceited that he's abominable, or are we creating someone with self-esteem who can be successful? And if we try and teach humility, are we going to knock a person down to where he feels or she feels I'm nobody and therefore can't perform even normal daily functions to the extreme? When you get to the extreme, that's what you have. So I think what we'll do tonight is we'll discuss this issue called Anava. We'll see what it is. We'll see how we're supposed to develop it. Because if not, we're playing with fire. It's a very dangerous midah when it gets out of hand, this self-esteem issue. The Baalei Musar, they try and tell people to feel they're nothing. One of the great expressions of Anava, Ma'ani Mahayai. What am I? What is my life? Please don't respect me. That sometimes the biggest Baal Gava tells you that. But really, it's an expression that's taught. Who am I? What am I? The Gemara brings several cases of Anava, of humility. It says, who's the greatest? If you say it's David HaMelech, you can prove it from a pasuk that he was very anan. He says, Ani tola'at velo ish. I'm a worm. I'm an insect. I'm not a person. Fantastic. What anava. He's the king of Israel. He killed Goliath. Led many battles that were successful. Was Tamid Chacham. And yet, then he hung out with Shmuel, you know. Pretty good position to be in. When he wanted to decide where to build the Beit HaMikdash, he sat down with Shmuel and they sat down and learned together. Imagine sitting down with Shmuel and Navi to learn with. Yet he says, Ani tolad velo ish. Gemara says he's not number one. Why? Abraham Avinu said, Va'anochi afar va'efer. I am afar. Dirt, dust, ve'efer, ashes. Well, that's not even alive. A worm is alive. So he's a greater anav than David. Comes the Gemara and says, but there's Moshe. Moshe and Aaron made a statement, v'nachnu ma, what are we? Abraham, when he said afar va'efer, afar can be made into bricks. Bricks can make a building. You can make china from it. Put it on the swani. Afar is very valuable. Efer is the ashes of what once was something. A building that burns down leaves ashes. A utensil that burns leaves ashes. At least it was something once. But Nachmama means we're nothing. Never was, never is, never will be. Nothing. But, that's the greatest ana. So that's taught. But when you think about it, is that what we want? For a young boy, young girl to grow up thinking, I'm nothing? The educators will tell you no. I'm not going to start up with her. That's got to be a school policy to give the kids self-esteem, good self-image. So we have to understand that the Torah attitude is that if you're going to feel that way, like David, like Abraham, like Moshe, it's not in relation to other people. It's relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In relationship to God Himself, I'm nothing. I'm zero. Harambam teaches, if you want to learn Yirat Shamayim, study nature. When you see all that goes on in the galaxies, and then you try and measure, and they give you light years, and they give you microscopic, and they tell you how they study. I was even talking to someone about just, we were walking out of shul the other night, and they said, somebody said, you know, we're getting old. The truth is, we're not. But when we were younger, we used to joke around. I remember it wasn't so long ago. I'm not that old. I know what I look like, Martin, but I'm not that old. We used to say in school, or even as teenagers, I saw this old guy, 50-year-old man. Wow, 50, he was running. Now we got 70-year-old guys in the marathon running 26 miles. So, Haramam said, if you study, if you look and you think about what's going on there, the microscopes, the scientific procedures that give a person, they're able to actually keep a person alive 80, 90, 100 years is not uncommon now. It's all science. It's fantastic. Rambam says you study science, you realize how small we are. You learn to love Hashem, and you learn to fear Hashem. When you realize how little you are, how small you are. I remember once Rabbi Fran came to Shaar Etzion, and he told us a story. And a lot of what you hear tonight will be what I remember from that particular talk that he gave us, that he went Ben Azmanim on vacation with his wife to the Grand Canyon. And he was in awe. Just the size and the space. And I don't know if any of you have been out west. I was out west. It's amazing. The space. When they say the big sky is only out west, you stand there and you just look, and the sky is like 20 times bigger than it is over here. It's the same sky. And the size of the mountains and the plateaus, I mean, the canyon is just so big. And then one tourist turned to another and said, how come everybody's whispering? And Rabbi Fran realized, when you're in the presence of someone great, you're afraid to say anything, so you whisper. And being at the Grand Canyon, under that big sky, by that natural wonder, everybody felt how big Hashem is. Closeness to Hashem. And that's why they felt small. They're whispering, they're afraid to talk. We say Moshe Rabbeinu, Vayish Moshe Anav Mikol Adam. Ish Moshe was Anav. You might think you have a man who never accomplished anything, and therefore he should be Anav. He should be humble. He was a king. He went to Shamayim to get the Torah. He wrestled with angels. He killed Og Melech HaBashan. He killed Sihon Melech. It says in the Midrashim that in the years that he spent in Midian, and then he went to the middle of Africa, to Kush and other places, where he was a general and they had many battles. The man knew he was smart, he knew he was great, he knew he was powerful, he knew he was a leader, he knew he was the closest one to Hashem on earth. And the Torah tells us he's anav. So we see from that, and that alone, although I can give you other proofs, that knowing that you have talents, knowing that you're special, knowing that you even perform better than other human beings, doesn't make you lack any anava whatsoever. You could still be humble. Let me explain what it is. If a person has a good voice, natural talent for singing, they probably could sing and amaze other people who don't have that natural talent. It could lead to conceit. Many people suffer from it because of the talent they have. They were the smartest and the brightest or the fastest or the strongest or the... Once you put EST at the end, it's cause for conceit. Because it's the last three letters of best. And in any group, only one can be the best. You have 500 students in a high school, one is the best, everybody else is in the 499. So this EST, best, strongest, fastest, wisest, that person can become conceited unless they realize it's all a gift. I can feel I'm the best and still be humble if I acknowledge it's a gift. If I acknowledge it's a gift from Hashem, I mean, let's say somebody works hard all their life. They think they're doing it, okay, that's a problem, and they make a lot of money. That's a different class, how to look at the money you make. But let's say a person made a lot of money, and they feel good about themselves. Oh, they're successful, and they start giving lectures, and they go around the country telling people how they made it. Is that right or wrong? Well, you could say I made it. But if you know it's a gift, would you feel any differently if a person came out of the womb, Bill Gates' son. Bill Gates writes a will and passes on, the guy now has billions of dollars. Does he have any right to be conceited? What did he do? He was born. There's a guy in a poor neighborhood, doesn't have shoes to wear, was also born. One was born with money, one was born without money. So having money that you didn't earn, that you didn't produce, why does that make you conceited? But the real question is, if you earned the money and you made the money, why does that make you conceited? You see, because they're both a gift from Hashem. There's a gift that comes through your hishtadlut, and there's a gift that comes, we call naturally. So all you gorgeous people out here who feel you're so gorgeous, you're right, you're all very good looking people. I travel a lot, this crowd is very good looking. You're one of the better looking crowds I ever spoke to. But guess what, it's a gift. You didn't produce it, you didn't earn it. So why be conceited about looks? And the same is true of brains. And the same is true of money. And the same is true of athletic ability. All the things that make people conceited are really only gifts. So why be conceited? Knowing that it's a gift. They called you this time. You'll get the tape. We'll get your free copy. Knowing it's a gift is the first step to humility. Did you all hear Daddy? I didn't hear Mom. I heard Daddy. Okay. I'm old, but I still... Thank God.
He heard it too.
I know. I played dumb too. There's a very famous thing about, you know, the first baby. The husband, who was an insomniac, suddenly can't wake up. He'll even pull the covers and give her a kick just to help she really hears. Let me give you a Gemara that's very interesting. It's a beautiful Gemara in Sota. At the end of Masechet Sota, having nothing to do with the subject of Sota, the suspected woman, the Gemara lists some great people and says when they passed on, a certain trait was lost from the world. Kishemed this one, batla this. Kishemed this one, batla that. And it's just a formula. When this one died, this was now, imagine when Esther died, beauty was lost to the world. There's no more beauty. Yeah, because nobody can compare. That's the kind of Gemara. She's not one of the cases, but I just wanted to bring it to you. So it says, when Rabbi died, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the great rabbi, the billionaire, who made the decision to write down the Torah, the Gemara, the Mishnah, when he died, Batla Anava, humility died. And that's our subject tonight. So comes along, not a Tana, an Emora, which is a lower level of rabbi, one of the Gemara, who cannot dispute even Rabbi in a Mishnah. He needs another Tana, because that's the way it works. He comes along and says, how could you say that? There's me. You like that? You got it. If you say there's me, how humble are you? And that's what shocks people about the Gemara. Kishemet Rabbi Batla Anava Amar Rav Yosef Ala Ana. What about me? So it sounds like Rav Yosef, who is claiming to be the great humble person, the greatest on earth, is really very conceited. So what is he meaning? He's not joking. He's not playing with us. Very serious statement. Rav Yosef was one of the greatest rabbis. Sometime, I guess in his middle age, Rav Yosef lost his sight and became blind. That would be bad enough, but many people function pretty well without sight. Then Rav Yosef forgot all his learning. And in many Gemarot, you see his students correct him. Or they tell him, they correct him politely, Rabbi, didn't you teach us this way? They have to remind him. What does that make Rabbi Yosef? Humble, conceited, that's not the point. The point of his statement is, there's me. You know what I am? I'm an example of what all the talents on earth are. What all the things that you put EST after are. The greatest, the fastest, the wisest, the strongest, the smartest, the richest. It's all transitory. It's all temporary. Hashem gave it. He could take it away like that. So what's there to be proud of? You want to be humble? Look at me. I was smart. And I could see, and now I can't do either, he said. Doesn't that prove something about what you think you have? We should realize from this that what we call a gift, that special talent you have that you call a gift, is really only a loan. And it can be called in at any time. But we call it a gift for a special reason. To let you know why it was given to you. It's to make you responsible. If you have a special talent, if you have a special asset that can be used in a positive way, knowing that it's on loan to you and not someone else, you now have an obligation and a responsibility to use it that way. And the greater the ability, the greater the responsibility. So now, when we look back at what we just said, we realize that the gifts you have, and each one of you has your own. Some of you have two, some of you have five, some of you have three. And stop concentrating on what you don't have. It's not healthy. But if you look at what you do have, rather than feel I'm conceited, look at it as a gift on loan from Hashem that gives me an obligation or makes me obligated to perform in a certain way and to use that gift not only for my benefit but for the benefit of others. To do what Hashem intended for me to do with this. Now, I said that the Baal Ga'ava is abominable. What's so bad about it? He thinks, or she thinks, as they say in downtown, she's God's gift. What do you want from me? He made me this way. I'm just fabulous. There's not too many perfect people walking around, but I happen to be one of them. What can I do? I'm beautiful, I'm well off, I got the right trainer, I got the right manicurist, I'm fantastic. You want me not to know it? And you know something? We should be able to ignore it. And say, so what? You know, in Disney World is one thing, but in Disneyland there were four lands. One is called Fantasyland. Maybe she's living in Fantasyland. Bada, Isa! But the fact of the matter is, there's an offshoot of this image that really, really does affect us so that we can't leave that person off in their own little dream world. You see, that person is self-oriented. Not only do they have an image that's distorted, to have a focus that's inwardly directed. Me first. I. And a Jew, by definition, is a Baal Chesed. A Jew, by definition, is supposed to give. Be concerned with others. Look to what the needs are. I went to a function last night, one of the 900 functions this summer, for a great cause. One of the 900 great causes that are having functions this summer. And we're standing around, milling around before the program part with the speeches and all. And we were talking about how phenomenal it is that you can go day in, day out to another function to fill the need of somebody else, donate your money, your time, your effort, and never finish. And what was amazing, that in this glorious community of ours, everybody loves to do it. You want this kind of, no problem. But who do I write the check to? Where do I have to go? What do I have to do? And they're giving and giving and giving and giving and giving and doing more and more because they're other oriented. There's a problem out there. We've got to do something about it. Somebody needs help. That's the definition of being a child of Abraham Avinu. And that's what a Jew is. So if someone's inwardly focused, worrying only about I and selfishly so, that's what a Baal Gava's focus is, then that person becomes an abomination to Hashem because it's a distortion of what the person is. It's a misuse of everything Hashem gave him. It's a violation of the trust of the loan. Could you imagine, I give a guy a loan. comes to me, he says, listen, I understand you have a free loan fund, Rabbi, how you doing? I said, oh, no problem, what's your project? Well, I'm a small retailer, I'm really struggling from day to day. I have an opportunity. If I had so much money, I'd get involved with this partner. Me and the partner then open up a chain of these things. We rolled out the original, it's really doing well. I think by next year, not only can I pay you back, I'll be one donating to your fund. Really fantastic. A year later, guy comes back, says, you're here to pay, says, no, I need another loan. Oh, the business grew? No. Remember the business? Why should I even know? What happened to the 100,000? What happened to the $1 million I gave you? Oh, that. Well, I got home with intentions of investing with this guy. And my wife was saying that the house needs a fixing. And then we decided, listen, everybody goes away for intercession, and we haven't gone for years, so. And the pool, and the car, stop. Before you know it, you know, Rabbi, $1 million doesn't go a long way today. But if you give me the loan now, the guy's still available, the deal's still available, by next year it's you violated my trust the first time. Fool me once, shame on, you know. Fool me twice, shame on me. I can't. It's disgusting what you did. I gave you a gift, a loan, with intention to help you, so that you can make the most of your life, and you squandered it away? So the Baal Gava was given attributes, talents, means, circumstances, family, community, I don't know what to add up all the positive things a person could have, and that person starts to focus on self, and Hashem says, it's disgusting, that's not why I gave it to him. A Jew has to look through glass. I forget the rabbi's name, but once there was a rabbi and he had a student who he thought was going to be a great person. He was very good at chesed. Left the yeshiva, went into business, came back and told the rabbi, you know, I miss those days of idealism. Those days when I was younger, when things were seemed so bright in the future and my opportunity to help people. And I don't know what happened. I can't even write a $52 check to Siddhaka today. I just very stingy. And the rabbi took him to the window. I said, look outside. The guy looked outside. He said, what do you see? I said, I see a lot of people going back and forth. He said, come with me. He took him over and says, look. And looked in the mirror. He said, what do you see? I said, I see myself. He said, what's the difference between a window and a mirror? A little silver. The money got in the way. When you had nothing, you looked through the window. You saw a lot of people. And they needed you. A little silver got involved with the window. And now you only see yourself. You want to hear a deep thought? And this I remember from Rabbi Friend in that talk. Because it's a very deep thought. And usually I like to pluck a deep thought and grind it and digest it so I don't lose it. You go out to a social function. You tell somebody, hi, how you doing? I'm okay, and they walk away. How do you react? What do I do to that person? Why is that person angry with me? Why would they insult me like that? What did I do to her? In fact, I'm always so nice to her. Anything wrong with that analysis? Maybe it's something I should do to apologize to her. Let's make it positive. Maybe I hurt her in some way. I better check back my last few comments. Maybe I did something to hurt her. Did I invite her to my wedding? Did I wear the same dress to an affair? What did I do wrong? You know what's wrong with that conversation? You're at the center. Who says they don't have a problem that doesn't involve you? Who says there's something that concerns them that has nothing to do with you? And you said hello, and they said hello back, but they just couldn't be sociable at that moment because of something having nothing at all to do with you. But you cannot imagine any circumstance in anybody's life that's not centered around you. What an amazing thought. Why am I with the center? Like, I didn't do nothing. See this guy? I would imagine from his size and shape and face and beard that he's less than 20 years old. A person who's less than 20 years old spends all of his or her time, you're included, wondering what others think of that person. How do I look? What am I wearing? What would they say? What does the teacher think? What does mommy think? What do the girls think? What do the boys think? Will they pick me? Will they like me? Me. Twenty to 40, when you mature and you're in the prime of your life, so to speak, that's what you think. A person doesn't care what anybody thinks. What do I care? They don't want to talk to me? It's their loss. They don't like my purple suit, my pink shirt, my orange tie? Tough. Big deal. I don't care. You know, a teenager will not leave the house because there's a zit right on the cheek. And if I walk into that room of 1,000 people at the wedding, they're all looking at me. And all they could see is my zit. So I'm not going. They go to the party and I don't even know what happened to them. I don't even see them. But from their viewpoint, right? And then when they're 20 to 40, I don't care. I wear an earring. I have a ponytail. I don't care what anybody thinks. I can wear the wildest fashions and I don't care. What happens after 40? Okay, folks. Some of you are, some of you are not. Let me tell you what happens. You find out that nobody really cares. You know what's the problem with life? That daddy? Buenas noches, señor. You know what's the problem? A good percentage of humankind never get to stage 3. They either stay at 1 or 2. They don't get to the stage where they realize, I don't have to live for anybody else because nobody cares. Truth is, a person who feels good about themselves, one who has a positive self-image, doesn't need the approval. And that person could be humble. That's the person who can have humility. I know what I am. I know it's from Hashem. I'm going to use it the best way I can. And I hope everybody else understands. But in the meantime, if I know that, I'm on solid ground. Number 3, Rabbi Frank quote tonight. Great, great, great one. I got this young man, I got this young lady here tonight. I want them to grow up to be great models of humility and self-esteem combined. They're going to be anav and they're going to be self-confident. But I know that peer pressure, and maybe I criticized them a little too much, and maybe they didn't get 100 on the test, and maybe they're not the fastest runner, or the highest jumper, or the best swimmer. How am I going to make this person grow up the right way, with the right balance of humility and self-esteem? It's the story, and I know Joey's going to smile, of the 8-cow wife. A guy goes to an island in the Philippines or in Tahiti or somewhere. And when he gets to the island, he hears legend about a great rich man who lives on this island. And he's anxious to meet him. And the guy in describing him says, not only is he a great man, he has an 8-cow wife. Look at the eyebrows touching. What's an 8-cow wife? Well, it seems to be. He saw the face, puzzled face. And so he said, listen, you know, we're simple people. When a man wants to get married, he's got to bring a dowry to the father. And most girls on the island, they bring one or two cows. And if a girl is really, really, really special, maybe three or four. Now, someone who's fit to be a princess, been one or two every generation, there's 6-cow wife. But this man, not only is he smart, not only is he rich, not only is he respected, he has an 8-cow wife. So the tour guide takes him around, he sees all the sights, and finally they get to the rich man's house, they sit down for dinner. They're being served beautifully. The house is very pretty. Not for an island, you know. Villa, beautiful, beach, everything. And the host turns to the tourist and says, I guess you heard I'm a very successful businessman. Yes, I did. And you probably also heard that although I drive a hard bargain, I paid the extraordinary sum of 8 cows for my wife. And you're probably wondering why. Yeah. Would you like to see my wife? He says, well, I'm an ogle. If you don't mind, he says, my wife was the nice lady who brought in our drinks and our fruit, a very nice lady. He's thinking to himself, nice lady, respectable, but 8 cows? Doesn't look it. And the businessman looked at him and said, I see you're puzzled. She's not exactly what you pictured to be an 8-cow wife. But let me tell you, if you saw her when I met her, you'd wonder why I even married her. She slouched. Her hair was a little unkempt. Dressed nice, but not exactly stylish. And I didn't even know what got me, but I decided I wanted to marry her. And I said, how am I going to make this woman into something special? The best she possibly could be. You know what I'll do? I'll pay 8 cows. And suddenly the word will go out, she's not just a regular girl. She's an 8-cow wife. And she'll change. She'll grow into the image of that special person. Rabbi Akiva was an Ama Aretz. Rabbi Akiva was spotted by a rich, beautiful young lady named Rachel. Rachel said, you're a special person. She said, not me, I'm honest. You're a big Tamid Chacham. I hate Tamid Chacham. I bite them and I bite them like a donkey. I break their bones underneath the skin. I'll marry you if you learn Torah. says, I'll do it. Her father, one of the three richest men in Yerushalayim, said, if you marry him, I disown you. She did. And they lived on a bed of straw in a barn. And then he went away to study for 12 years and he came back. He overheard her saying, I wish you'd learn another 12 years to a neighbor. He went another 12 years. 24 years later, he comes back with 24,000 students. He's a top guy. And they won't let this poverty-stricken woman approach the great rabbi. And he says, let her through. Sheli v'shelachem shelahi. What I have and what you have is hers. Simple meaning. It's all in her merit. She gave up all her money. She gave up 24 years with her husband so that I could go and learn and become the Talmid Chacham, the Rabbi Akiva, the greatest rabbi from Moshe Rabbeinu Akiva. And probably from Moshe Rabbeinu Tanel, Rabbi Akiva. You know, I became that way, you would think, simply speaking, because she sacrificed. She made me what I am today, as they say. But in tonight's talk, let's look at it differently. She told me, you're smart. You have a beautiful neshama. I'll give up the billions that my father has if you'll marry me and study Torah. You know something? I started to feel like a Talmid Chacham. I started to fit the role of a Talmid Chacham. Not because I was, but because she told me I was. She created a self-image for me that I grew into. What's mine and what's yours is from her. So loving parents. The best thing you can give your children is not a PlayStation 2. I understand it's a new portable one, right? I never saw one, but I hear about them. Is that still the hot toy? I don't know. Okay, I just want to make sure. I don't want to be too old-fashioned, you know. I miss some technological advances in between, you know. By the way, this guy, all I'm talking about. The greatest gift you can give a child is not electronics, and it's not an automobile, and it's not a suit of clothing, and it's not a lot of money, and it's not a house. Faith in themselves. It's the greatest thing to hear. There are people who had children who were not the greatest, who grow up to be so happy, so self-fulfilled, so satisfied with life. And yet they don't have more than others. They don't have as much as others. Somehow they're satisfied. Somehow they feel good about themselves. Because mommy told me, I'm good. I'm great. I'm an achiever. I can do it. And I did. To the best of my ability. And that's good enough for me. While others have a very talented child who comes home with a report card that looks like a Greek salad, it's all olives. For those in tape land, not familiar, olive is an A. not a vegetable or a fruit. And they say, how come you got B+ in math? Oh, you did it? Don't feel embarrassed. Everybody does. You look at the report card. It's almost perfect. And you spot the flaw. There was a group of tourists. They went to Europe. And in Europe, they had many fantastic buildings with great artwork. And they traveled from Europe to Turkey. And they're even more fantastic. A different time period, different style. And they went into a cathedral or some type of fancy building with the dome ceilings. And the wife was in awe. I guess she wanted to buy one for the house, maybe. Fantastic artwork. Made up thousands of small 1-inch tiles. Mosaic. And she looked and she said, look at this ceiling. What a talent. What a beautiful work of art. It should last forever so generations can appreciate what we're looking at. Honey, do you see it? He looks up and says, it may be nice to you, honey, but look over there. You see there's a tile missing over there? That's the B+. There are some people who see what's missing, and there's some people who see what we have. To give a person self-esteem. You know what's wrong with a Baal Gava? Do you know you don't know a Baal Gava? Oh, I know. Oh, have you met him? No, I know you. Now that you're talking about it, you want a list? I'll give you a list. Let me get my wedding list now. Show how many Baal Gavas I know. Conceited, haughty, hard to deal with, rude, yelling at the waitress, putting down the worker, belittling his wife in public. Yeah, you don't know anybody? I know him. You want me to tell you about him? That person has no self-confidence. That person has no self-esteem. That person lacks a lot. And that person has to cover up from every angle so people don't know. So they put down a worker. They embarrass their wife. They criticize their children. Just so nobody will notice that I ain't no good. That I don't cut it. That I don't measure up. But when a person does, they could be Moshe Rabbeinu. They could be Aaron HaKohen, Shmuel HaNavi, or even Rav Yosef. I'm blind, I forgot my learning. What could I do? I had a gift. I had a responsibility. I used it the best I could while I had it. But it's all transitory. So I don't take credit for it. I just appreciate it. If you have humility, it comes from your self-esteem. Your self-esteem has to be based on knowing it's an opportunity given to you by God and the tools to do it with. And if you're conceited and rude and you put down people, it's probably because you don't feel self-confidence. The Baal Gava has no self-esteem. It's not that I'm so great. I know I'm not subconsciously, so I have to cover up. So that's tonight's lesson. To work on our inner self so that we're good to nice to others. That's the way it happens. By building up the personalities of those around us, by giving them the confidence to use the talents they have, we develop people who end up being able to give freely to others without not going out because of the zit on my face. Because really nobody's looking. And let's hope we get to stage 3. Okay?